This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I have a wonderful story for you that, since I thought it was going to be rainy, would be great. But it's still great. It's called The Rising of Governor Morris, and it is a ghost story. So, stay tuned for that. I'll give you a second to get settled, and I'll be right back. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTOL 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. That was a nice change of pace. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G. I'm bringing you The Rising of Governor Morris out of Morrisiana, the Bronx. Oh, and it's retold by F.E. Schlosser. Mistress Ann Morris sat on a couch near the fire, watching the flames flicker and listening to the sounds of the wind and the rain whipping against the house. Her three-year-old son was sitting on the floor by the window, playing with his toys and chattering softly to himself. Occasionally, he would look up and smile at his mother, and she would try to smile back at him. She pulled restlessly at her black-edged handkerchief, trying not to weep as she gazed at the portrait of her handsome husband, Governor, and thought of the many times she had sat in this room with him on just such blustery nights while their son played nearby. Now he was gone, and little Governor would grow up without his father, without the influence of the handsome, witty, fashionable, intelligent man who had sired him. It would be up to her to make sure that her son knew what a splendid man his father had been. Governor Morris had been born in this very house in 1752, the only son of his father's second marriage. The Morris family was wealthy, and Governor had attended local preparatory schools and then enrolled at King's College at the age of 12. He had, Governor once told Anne, been both the most intelligent and the laziest boy in school. She had laughed with him at the description. Then, when he was 14, he had accidentally upset a kettle of boiling water on his right side, burning his arm so badly that the doctor feared gangrene. His arm was saved, but he bore the scars all his life, and his arm was never much use after that. Anne pressed her lips tightly together to stop them from trembling as she remembered the feel of Governor's withered arm wrapped lovingly around her. His scars had never mattered to her. She jumped at the sound of little Governor's blocks toppling to the floor. He looked up at her with a happy smile, proud of the noise he had made. She smiled back, catching her breath because his smile was so like his father's. When the child turned back to his blocks, Anne lapsed again into her thoughts of her dear husband. Governor had gone on to law school and then was admitted to the bar after 3 years of study with one of New York's leading legal minds. His political career began in 1775 when he took a seat in New York's Revolutionary Provincial Congress. representing Westchester County. In 1776, he joined one of the special militia companies proliferating in New York City. These units acted as the city's Minutemen. Joining the Minutemen was so typical of Governor, Anne thought to herself. As a legislator, he was automatically exempted from militia duty, but he had always viewed active service as a moral obligation and insisted on joining the militia in spite of his withered arm. Governor had excelled as a member of the provincial Congress. He helped transform the New York colony into an independent state, and the new state constitution was largely his work. He became chairman of the legislators' Ways and Means Committee, which was charged with funding the state's war effort. In May 1776, at the age of 24, the state picked governor to coordinate defense measures with both George Washington's main army and the Continental Congress. Then, in the late summer and early fall of the same year, the British invaded New York City and overran much of Westchester County. Governor had not spoken much of this period of time to his wife, but Anne had learned that Mistress Morris, the governor's mother, was a loyalist who had turned the family estate over to the enemy for military use, and Governor had withdrawn with the provincial Congress to Fishkill. Anne's thoughts were interrupted by the chiming of the clock as it struck 9. A little knock sounded on the sitting room door. She bade the person to enter, and her son's French nursemaid came into the room. "Would you like me to take the child now, Madame Morris?" the girl asked. "I will keep him here with me," Anne said. "I will put him to bed tonight, Marie. You will not be needed until morning. Have the servants lock up the house and go to bed." The girl nodded and departed from the room, closing the door behind her. Little Governor was laughing to himself as he came over to his mother to show her a brightly colored block. Anne admired it, and the little boy squirmed with delight before returning to his toys. Anne took a sip of her now cold tea, still thinking about the Revolution. It was in 1777, she remembered, that Governor served as a member of the New York Committee of Safety. He had visited the Northern Front in the aftermath of the British capture of Fort Ticonderoga. From there, he had coordinated state support of the Continentals operating in that area, and then he had journeyed to Washington's headquarters to plead for reinforcements. In 1778, while serving as a delegate to the Continental Congress, Governor was selected to serve on a committee being sent to Valley Forge to coordinate military reforms with George Washington. The pitiful plight of the troops in the snow shocked him, and Governor threw himself into his organizational work, serving as the Continental Army spokesman in Congress. His support for Washington, Nathaniel Greene, and Frederick von Steuben directly contributed to the success of the training and structural reforms. Governor's political career was cut short when he was defeated in his bid for re-election to the State Assembly in the fall of 1778. So Governor decided to relocate to Philadelphia and resume the practice of law. While he was there, he wrote a series of political essays that were published in the Pennsylvania Packet and signed only as an American. Governor suffered a personal tragedy in May 1780. He was mounting a carriage in haste when the horses started up. His left foot was caught in the spokes of the wheel, and his ankle was mangled. The doctor who attended him, his own physician, was out of town, removed the leg below the knee. When Governor's doctor returned, he opined that the leg could have been saved. Governor never complained about the loss of his leg, Anne mused, except when he slipped on muddy cobblestones. Neither his burnt arm nor his missing limb ever slowed him down. He danced, rode, and sailed all his life. Governor was ill for several months following the amputation and remained out of the political limelight until 1781, when he became the principal assistant to the Superintendent of Finance for the United States. In 1787, Governor Morris represented Pennsylvania at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. He was one of the leading figures at the convention, standing in the thick of the decision-making process. It was Governor, Anne thought proudly, who was the author of much of the Constitution, including the noble phrases of that document's preamble. "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure
the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Governor subsequently left public life for a time to devote his attention to business. He purchased the family home from his half-brother Louis and moved back to New York. In 1789, Governor traveled to France on a business venture. There he encountered the growing dissent of the French people, witnessing firsthand the parading of an unpopular government minister's head on a pike through the streets of Paris and the public vendetta against Marie Antoinette. In spite of the terrible political climate, Governor created quite a stir among the married ladies in Paris. Governor had been an inveterate womanizer during his bachelor years. Witty and fashionably attired, the one-legged Governor Morris had entertained a string of ladies across two continents and had once shared a mistress with Talleyrand, one of the most important diplomats in Europe. Governor had never discussed such things with Anne, of course, but his relatives, who disapproved of her, had made sure she knew about them in detail. George Washington appointed Governor as minister to France in 1792 to replace Thomas Jefferson. The outbreaks of terror continued, growing worse and worse, and after 2 years, the American government called Governor from his diplomatic duties. Governor chose to continue his business travels in Europe rather than return to America. When he finally came home in 1799, he was a very wealthy man. Governor settled into the family manor and became active in the Federalist Party, allying himself with his friend Alexander Hamilton. As a private citizen, Governor devoted himself to managing his extensive estates, and in 1807 he was named by the state of New York to head the commission to lay out a street plan for Manhattan. Anne's thoughts were interrupted by a soft wail from her son. She picked him up, cradling him in her arms, and sat down with him before the fire. Comforted by his mother, little Governor curled against Anne and fell asleep. She kissed the top of his head, filled with a sudden joy in this little life she had created with his father. This son of hers was a miracle indeed. She had never expected to marry at all after the scandalous happenings of her youth. Yet after much adversity, she had married a man she loved very deeply, and who had given her status, wealth, and a son. Governor began writing to Anne sometime in 1808. She was the daughter of his friend Thomas Mann Randolph of Tuckahoe, Virginia. When Governor heard that she had fallen on hard times, he offered to help her in any way he could. Anne frowned a bit. Fallen on hard times. What an understatement that was. During their correspondence, Anne had eventually come to trust Governor and had told him her sad story. Anne had been born into one of the first families in Virginia. Although they had little money, she and her sister had been well educated in French literature and music lessons, as was required by their elevated rank in Virginia society. She had been engaged to marry Theodoric, the younger brother of her sister's husband, but her fiancé had died before they could be wed. Then Anne had discovered she was pregnant. Her child came early and was stillborn. The family tried to keep the matter quiet, but scandalous rumors of poison and murder quickly spread throughout Virginia. Anne was accused of having a child with her sister's husband, Richard, and he was charged with the murder of the baby. Richard was brought to trial for the crime and was acquitted. Although Anne was never brought to trial, the terrible charges continued to haunt her every move. She was turned out of her home and moved aimlessly from place to place seeking work. Her path eventually led to a boarding house in Greenwich Village, where, destitute and alone, she eked out a living teaching school. Anne was still a good-looking woman at the age of 35, and her spirit had bent, but not broken, under adversity. Then in April 1809, Governor had arrived at her door in a fancy carriage driven by French servants and offered her the position of housekeeper in his home. Governor admired Anne for her intelligence, her fierce courage, and her will to survive. During the months she acted as his housekeeper, he wooed her and won her love. They were married on Christmas Day, to the considerable astonishment of the friends and family who had been invited to Mauriciana for a holiday dinner and who had never expected the 57-year-old Governor to marry. Oh, how the family had hated her, and Governor, for this unexpected turn of events. She and Governor had stood before the minister in the midst of a sumptuous setting, neoclassic tapestries, gilded chairs, fancy paintings, and Anne had been married in a worn, faded gown with patches on the elbows. All the time, the minister was reading from the Book of Common Prayer. Anne had been aware of her new relatives hating her for standing between them and the inheritance of Governor's fortune. They protested greatly, but Governor was prepared for them and took delight in apologizing to them for having been impertinent enough to marry for his own pleasure. Their marriage had been a success from the start. They shared many interests, and Anne traveled throughout western New York with Governor as he carried out his duties as chairman of the Board of Canal Commissioners, which was in charge of planning and building the Erie Canal. Governor had long dreamed of a canal system that would connect the Hudson River and Lake Erie, and now his dream was becoming a reality. Their son, Governor Morris Jr., was born in February 1813, destroying the last hope of Governor's nieces and nephews who had once been his heirs. One of his nephews, David Bayard Ogden, had been particularly vicious, digging up gossip from Virginia and trying to wreck their marriage by insinuating that their child was really the son of a servant with whom Anne was having an affair. He encouraged one of Anne's cousins to write a malicious letter accusing her of bringing disgrace and death to their family. With Governor's understanding and support, Anne had publicly renounced her cousin's filthy accusations, and their marriage was further strengthened by the adversity, much to the chagrin of Governor's family. And now, Governor was dead. He died in November 1816 in the same room in which he had been born, and Anne was alone again except for her small son and the servants. Throughout the funeral, she had been aware of the fury and resentment of her husband's relatives as they watched her. Anne hugged her son tightly against her, afraid suddenly of what Governor's family might do to her and her child, now that he was not there to protect them. It was nearly midnight. The servants had all gone to bed, and Anne suddenly became aware of how weary she was. She stood up, cradling her sleeping son, and shivered as she listened to the rain and sleet hitting the windowpane. As she moved toward the door of the sitting room, she heard the sound of horses' hooves pounding their way to the front of the house. Anne hurried to the front hallway, wondering what emergency was bringing someone to her home at this late hour. There came a great pounding at the door, and a man's voice shouted, "Anne Morris, fetch us our cousin's will, or we will break into the house and take it." Anne's eyes widened as she recognized the voice of her husband's cousin. She clutched little Governor tightly to her chest and rang for the servants, hoping someone would hear her summons. The pounding came again, harder this time, and Anne moved back toward the sitting room, determined to lock herself in with her son. But she stopped short, staring at the coat of arms over the door. She thought she had seen it move. She gasped suddenly when one of the lions stretched and shook itself. Around the walls, the portraits began to move, the figures stirring and stretching within their frames as if newly awakened. Then the figure of a knight leaped down from his frame, alighting on the floor with a clink of armor. Gravely, he struck his shield with his sword three times, the tones ringing forth like a bell through the pounding on the door and the shouts from outside. Anne stared at the ghost in fear and alarm. She did not know if she should be fleeing from him or from the kinsman who threatened her. Then the ghost called out in a deep, hollow voice, "Governor Morris, come forth." Anne cried out in alarm. Overhead, she heard a footfall in the room where Governor had died, then the familiar thump of a peg leg hitting the floor. Anne stood frozen in place, watching as the ghost of her husband, a sword in his hand, descended the staircase and entered the hallway. The shade of Governor Morris gestured toward the front door with his sword. The door blasted outward, throwing the intruders backward down the stairs. He moved forward without haste, followed by the warrior from the painting, and together the ghosts stepped into the rain and sleet of the cold night, swords raised. Anne heard several voices scream in terror, then the sound of her husband's kinsmen hastily mounting their horses and galloping away. The front doors closed with a bang, and the light from the candelabrum on the mantel flickered. Anne clutched her still sleeping son to her chest, wondering if she dared to move. Then, Governor, her beloved husband, materialized in front of her, a tender smile on his face. Taking the candelabrum from the mantel, the ghost led his wife from room to room of their mansion, showing her the secret drawers and shelves where he had hidden many of the deeds to his various properties and other important papers, money and jewels. All the things he had meant to show her before death parted them. He stopped at last beside the fire in the sitting room where they had often sat on just such a blustery night while their son played nearby. Gently he sat her down beside the fire and stooped as if to kiss her. At that moment, the clock on the mantel struck one, and Governor vanished into his portrait on the wall. Anne sat very still, tears coursing down her cheeks as she bade her husband goodbye in her heart. Then she stood, cradling her son in her arms, and went up to bed. That was Rising of Governor Morris, as retold by S.E. Schlosser. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here at 104.3 KTOO. I hope you enjoyed that story as much as I did. First, I love the bio of the man, and then there's a ghost story in it as well. So, can't get better than that. I'll be right back. Please stay tuned. Hi there, this is Ms. G, and I'm back, and we have about 6 minutes left on the clock, so I wanted to actually read you a poem I found, since this is Poetry Month after all. It's by Maya Angelou. It's called Touched by an Angel. We, unaccustomed to courage, exiles from delight, live coiled in shells of loneliness until love leaves its high holy temple and comes into our sight to liberate us into life. Love arrives, and in its train come ecstasies, old memories of pleasure, ancient histories of pain. Yet if we are bold, love strikes away the chains of fear from our souls. We are weaned from our timidity in the flush of love's light. We dare be brave, and suddenly we see that love costs all we are and will ever be. Yet it is only love which sets us free. I was touched by an angel by Miss Maya Angelou. And I have another one of hers, and there is a little time on the clock there. So this one is called Remembrance. Your hand's easy weight, teasing the bees, hived in my hair, your smile at the slope of my cheek. On the occasion you press above me, glowing, spouting readiness, mystery rapes my reason. On the occasion when you have withdrawn yourself and the magic, when only the smell of your love lingers between my breasts, then, only then, can I greedily consume your presence. I was Remembrance by Ms. Maya Angelou. I thought those two were really great and very much like the wonderful story I read you tonight.
So that is pretty much my show for the night. And this has been Telling Tales with Ms. G. And I hope you enjoyed it. You're at KTOL 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And I'll just leave you with some music to enjoy. Until next time, good night.
One loves one, that man loves another. You get my two people in love with each other. It's an ocean and a tears. It's sorrow that fills the sea.
Since 1970, the poet Dave Smith has written well.